This is the lecture for Biochem 421 for November 16,
2009. Chapter 15, and we're talking just after sickle cell anemia. We're looking at the structure of hemoglobin, and this is November the 16th. Can you believe it? November 16th? 2009. Oh, yes. Time is passing. Are you? Never mind. Yes, I'm sure you're all passing. Absolutely. All right, so there's a couple pieces of information I need for you to know here. Just in general, please write on this overhead, carbon monoxide binds hemoglobin approximately 200 times more strongly than it does oxygen, So hemoglobin is 200 times more potent. Carbon monoxide is 200 times more potent than oxygen in hemoglobin binding. If in fact, there's three figures here, A, B, and C. We got A, the free heme with imidazole, B, the myoglobin slash hemoglobin carbon monoxide complex, and the oxymyoglobin. If you look at A, the free heme with imidazole, this is presuming that there's no globin around it. Carbon monoxide, of course, is a linear molecule. Its lone pair of electrons that come off this carbon is in line with the iron. If it were just free heme and carbon monoxide, the binding would be thousands of times more potent than oxygen. But what happens in both the myoglobin and hemoglobin complex, in which there is that protein, this protein glob around the heme, there is another histidine that sticks out into where the iron oxygen binds. And when carbon monoxide comes in here, it forces that carbon monoxide to be off-axis, as you see here in this figure, and thus weakens it down to just merely being 200 times more potent. And there you see the normal binding pattern for oxygen is at a tilt because the lone pairs of the oxygen are at 120 degrees relative to the plane. And therefore, the His E7 that exists there is not particularly interfering with oxygen binding. But nevertheless, oxygen still does not bind as strongly as carbon monoxide. So this is why you can die of carbon monoxide poisoning, in the fact that the carbon monoxide will occupy a site and actually trigger the cooperativity part of it. And yet, will not deliver nearly as much oxygen as you might suspect because it doesn't do the bottom part of the sigmoidal curve. It doesn't get ejected, as it were. We may talk about that later, we may not. But again, carbon monoxide does bind much more strongly. Is carbon monoxide actually produced naturally in your body? And the answer to that is yes. There are microscopic amounts of carbon monoxide produced in the degradation of hemoglobin, oddly enough. And so there are small amounts of carbon monoxide in your blood, and there are small amounts of this bound to the hemoglobin, but not enough to affect any kind of oxygen transport. Okay, what are the general features of allosteric regulation? And so this is some theory here that we need to go over, and we will today. Allosteric, of course, in general, they defined it as action at another site. You certainly can say that because the allosteric binding does not occur at the active or catalytic site. It occurs at some site other than that. But in order for that binding to have any effect on the catalytic site or binding site, there's got to be a change in the shape of the protein or enzyme. So enzyme-situated key steps in metabolic pathways are modulated by allosteric effectors. Typically, the effectors are produced elsewhere in the pathway or elsewhere by other regulatory mechanisms. The factors may be feed-forward activators or feedback inhibitors. Typically, the kinetics are sigmoidal, which means there's some cooperativity involved with it. And they have the assumption, at least for the mathematics, is that they have multiple identical subunits. And as you can see here, it demonstrates cooperativity. Here you see the classic hyperbolic versus sigmoidal structure. And this is assuming Michaelis-Menten type enzyme kinetics. How do we model this stuff? How do we model allosteric kinetics? Well, there are several models, the most common of which is called Minot, Wyman, and Changeau. Well, obviously, these are French scientists who developed the mathematical model. They proposed that that you can assume that the enzyme or regulated process or regulated protein can exist in two forms, T and R, where R stands for relaxed, and T stands for taut, or taut, or tight. All the subunits of oligomer must be in the same state. So if you have 100 molecules of hemoglobin, and 50 are R and 50 are T, what that means is that the 50 hemoglobin molecules that exist, all the subunits are either R, if they're tight, or if there are, all of them are relaxed. I'm not sure I made any sense on that. But at any rate, 100 molecules, half are T, half are R. The half that are T, within that half that are T, those 50 molecules of hemoglobin, every subunit is T. As opposed to, and then you go over to the R side, and you have all 50 R hemoglobin subunits, all subunits of that R are in the R form. So that's what it says here. All the subunits of an oligomer must be in the same state. T state predominates in the absence of substrate, and substrate binds much tighter to R than to T. So oddly enough, when you don't have the substrate, T predominates, but R binds more tightly to R than to T. And if you think about how hemoglobin behaves, you go, oh, yeah, that's probably about right. Yeah, if there's no oxygen, the T state or the deoxy state predominates. And when oxygen is present and the R state is present, then S binds better to R than to T. Okay, cooperativity is achieved because S substrate binding increases the population of R, which increases the sites available to S. So the cooperativity means the presence of a substrate shifts the equilibrium towards R, which allows even more S to bind. So there's kind of that cascade effect. So cooperativity is achieved because S binding increases the population of R, which increases the sites available to S. So the presence of the substrate shifts the equilibrium population from the T to the R, which allows even more S to bind. That's the kind of key. Ligands such as S are positive homotropic effectors. That means the positive means that, of course, you're shifting the S curve, the sigmoidal curve, to the right, meaning you're going to get more substrate binding. Homotropic means the same molecule that's a substrate is acting as a modulator. Right? The same substrate, the same molecule that's acting as a substrate is acting as a modulator, acting as a positive effector. Because you have heterotropic effectors as well. That is, the substrate is one thing, but the activator is another molecule. The substrate is one thing, and the activator is another one. That's heterotropic. And positive means, of course, the first one binds, allows the second one to bind even more. All right, there you go. Molecules that influence the binding of something other than themselves are called heterotropic effectors. Yes, yes, indeed. I just mentioned that. Hit that a couple times. Here's a little model, shall we say. Most multi-subunit proteins can be thought of existing in two populations. There's the R population, what does the R stand for? Relaxed. Okay? And what does the T stand for? Taut are taught. Exactly correct. And the L, in this case, stands for ligand. And the presence of the ligand actually shifts the relationship between the R population and the T population. So you get this L, this ligand concentration, or ligand relationship, and it's basically taught over R, and typically without the presence of a substrate, there's more tar, more tau, more taunt than relaxed. Okay, let me repeat myself. The theory of the Mano, Wyman, and Shangzhou model is that typically things are in the tight form, except in the presence of the substrate, when the population shifts toward the R form. So without a lot of substrate, you're going to have a large L. Not that you're going to do any mathematics with it. This is just an idea. So, B, substrate binding shifts equilibrium in favor of R. So here comes a substrate. Here comes a substrate. I mean, here's the population of tight and relaxed. And in comes a substrate. And the substrate binds to it and shifts equilibrium more toward the relaxed, the R form. So the presence of the substrate, in a homotrophic sense, shifts this population away from taunt to R. And either R loose with no binding, or R with a bound. Okay, there we go. Now you're going to find this a lot when we get into, and I love it, when we get into glycogen metabolism. This is going to be so fun. We're going to see this exact model in glycogen metabolism. Here's heterotrophic allosteric effects. Heterotrophic allosteric effects. This is a kind of an interesting model. Here again, you see the two models. Is that correct? You see the R0 and the T0. Now, the R0 means it's in the relaxed form with no substrate. And here's the T form. You got the taut form with no substrate. And to begin with, there's some population of R0 and T0. It's just sitting there minding its own business. Some are taunt, some are R. Mostly taunt, though. Now, the presence of a substrate, as you know, typically will shift the population once it binds to that, once it binds to these relaxed, shifts the population more toward the relaxed. Notice the substrate. Does the substrate bind the tight? Does the substrate bind the tight? No. Say no. No, with enthusiasm. No. Yes. Substrate does not. What is the whole purpose of this? Ladies and gentlemen, when you get into pharmacology in medical school, dental school, or graduate school, this is going to make an important sense to you. Okay? You don't want to have to learn it there. You want to learn it here. So that's why we're going through this, right? Everything I do points to the next level of your achievement. So this is just thought I'd throw that out at you. Now, so we're talking about, as I said, we're talking about drugs here, talking about prescriptions, about stuff you're going to be giving people. All right, so you got these two populations of enzyme that you want to influence. You'd like to actually inhibit it. Well, you can't inhibit all of it because there are populations in which there's a R form and the T form, and many times inhibitors only bind to the taunt form. Now, they increase the inactive form, but they don't whack it completely. There's always a population that's going to be active. At any rate, and so here you got a situation where the inhibitor simply increases the population of the taunt or tight, right? What did I just say? The inhibitor increases the population of the tight, right? The substrate can't bind with it. Here we have a substrate can increase its own population of relaxed form, but so can an activator binding at a different location on the enzyme. And it can increase its population of R form, and that activator then can, if it activates that R form, allows the substrate to bind more rapidly and more quickly or to a greater extent. But it does not bind at the active site. It binds at some other site other than that. Okay, here we go. Effective A, which is the activator, increase the number of R conformers, shifts the R0, T0 equilibrium so that the shifting is more toward the R0, more binding sites made for S, decrease in the cooperativity saturation curve, effector rate apparent, lowers the apparent value of L, increasing of inhibitor, increased number of T conformers, and thus inhibits association of both S and the activator by lowering the R0 levels. I increase the cooperativity substrate saturation curve, increase the apparent concentration. All right, so very handy model to know in mind. You're liable to be asked some questions about it, either multiple choice. I'm probably not going to ask you to regurgitate the model per se, but the concepts involved you certainly need to be able to recall. All right, now, is the activity of some enzymes controlled by both allosteric regulation and covalent modification? And that, of course, is yes. Yes, yes, yes. Allosteric regulation and covalent modification. Glycogen phosphorylase. Glycogen phosphorylase. And I think you, let's see here. Your metabolic thing today is, this week is what? It says glycogen, doesn't it? Yeah. All right. Well, what do you know? We hit the sweet spot. Glycogen phosphorylase cleaves glucose units from non-reducing ends of glycogen. There is an allosteric effector site at the subunit interface. Well, anyway. Okay. Glycogen breakdown. Glycogen breakdown, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, let's quickly get an overview, shall we? An overview of energy metabolism in your body. What's the fat? Do you have this overhead?
Yeah.
Okay, good. What is the form of energy most quickly mobilized in your body? Glucose or carbohydrate in general. That's exactly correct. What's a carbohydrate storage form in your body? What is it again? Glycogen. Again, what is it? Glycogen. I know you're writing it down. Just half write it, pay attention to me, just as this is a review anyway. All right, so what are the two main tissues that hold glycogen? Muscle tissue and liver tissue. Exactly correct. What's the purpose of glycogen being stored in muscle tissue? Quick energy for movement, for emergencies. What's the purpose of glycogen stored in your liver? Blood glucose levels, or you could more broadly say energy state of the blood, energy status of the blood. It helps regulate, modify that. Absolutely. We're going to be primarily looking at, can muscles export glucose? The answer is no. Muscles cannot export glucose. Glucose, in terms of maintaining energy levels in your blood, will never come from the muscle tissue. But Dr. Novak, don't we have energy equivalents coming from the muscle under certain times? Yes, we do. But not glucose. We have other energy equivalents, but not glucose. We have lactate primarily. Now, so you're now traveling into your liver. Okay? All right? And raise your hand if you've not had breakfast this morning. Raise your hand. Oh, very nice. Excellent. Outstanding choice. Anyway, so what's your brain surviving on right now?
Coffee.
Your coffee. Ah, yes, coffee. So your coffee has some glucose in it. A lot of glucose. Yeah, actually, is it glucose or what form is it? Oh, cream. So you don't add any carbohydrate except cream in your. You don't add extra sugar? Okay. So if the only carbohydrate she's getting in her coffee comes from cream, what form of carbohydrate is it? What? Lactose. What? Is that a monosaccharide or a disaccharide? Disaccharide. What are the two subunits of lactose? Well, your confidence is underwhelming. Galactose and glucose. Is lactose a reducing sugar? Say yes. Is maltose a reducing sugar? Yes. Is sucrose a reducing sugar? Why is that? The anomeric carbons are locked up to in covalent bonds to each other, and they can't form free aldehydes. So he does remember. Excellent. Now, we're talking about glycogen, which, of course, is a bunch of, it's a bunch of glucoses all together. Notice what it does here. What did I say? From the cleaves of glucose from the non-reducing ends of glycogen. There, in a glycogen molecule, how many reducing ends are there?
One.
Okay. How many non-reducing ends are there? Thousands. How many glycogen phosphorylases can attack a single glycogen molecule? Between 8 and 10, I think. All right, so basically, glycogen phosphorylase is the enzyme that breaks down glycogen. What did I just say? Right. So, it doesn't sound like it. Glycogen phosphorylase doesn't sound like a glycogen breakdown enzyme, but that's what the name of it is. All right, it's like basically a Pac-Man. Doink, doink, doink. Chopping off the non-reducing ends and producing free glucose 1-phosphate. Okay, boink, boink, boink. Until it gets into these very tight corners and then it gets into trouble. Glycogen breakdown are called glycogenolysis. Glycogenolysis from glycogen stores in the body, primarily. We're talking about the liver. This same thing occurs in the muscle tissue, however. There are three enzymes. Glycogen phosphorylase, which is highly regulated, produces G1P. What do you think G1P stands for? Thank you very much. That's correct. Then you have a glycogen debranching enzyme, and then a phosphoglucomutase. Let's take a look at it. Start here at the top. Glycogen. Let's see here. Where are we going on here? Okay, both glycogen and a debranching enzyme act on, glycogen gets acted on by a debranching enzyme and a glycogen phosphorylase produce glucose 1-phosphate. I want to talk about that debranching enzyme right now. Now, if you recall, I said glycogen is highly branched, but there are strong, long forms of amylose. And so the glycogen phosphorylase is going, dump, dump, chomp, 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 and it's producing glucose 6 or glucose 1-phosphate. Glucose 1-phosphate. Glycogen phosphorylase produces what? Do not forget it. Okay. Now, the problem is it's a big molecule, and it acts on 1-4 branches, but the 1-4 bonds, but it gets into these tight corners where the 1-6 branching comes in, and it can't get there. So it's been acting along right in here, chomp, 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 and it can't get in there quite. So another enzyme with two activities has to come along. This one enzyme with two activities, the first activity of the enzyme takes off these three of the four branching points that can't be gotten to by phosphorylase and attaches them to the end of another chain to make an amylose section of it. That same enzyme then cleaves that 1-6 bond. Okay? So that's called the glycogen debranching enzyme. What branches is it acting on? The branches are the corners at the 1-6 branch point that the glycogen phosphorylase can't get to. Contains two separate different activities, active sites on a single protein chain. Isn't that amazing? A single protein chain folds in three dimensions and produces two different active sites on the same protein. All right, and then once that is cleaved, then it's a bunch of amylose again, and the glycogen phosphorylase can go over and take over and make it. Now, notice what the glycogen phosphorylase makes. What does it make? Glucose 1-phosphate. But that is glucose 1-phosphate anywhere in glycolytic pathway?
No.
So it has to be transmogrified by a mutase into glucose what? 6-phosphate. All right, and you know where that ends. Now, what if you want to make it? What if you want to make it? And this is a little different here, but if you want to make it, this is how it's made, and we'll go through this. Take glucose 6-phosphate, make it into glucose 1. You transfer that glucose 1 onto a UTP molecule, a high-energy molecule, which primes that glucose and makes it UDP glucose. That's a high-energy glucose. That high-energy glucose then gets utilized by glycogen synthase and gets made into amylose, And the amylose then is acted upon by the branching enzyme, which eventually breaks branches on it and makes glycogen. So if you need energy short term, you're doing the right, doing the left side of this diagram. If you have energy and you're storing up glycogen, you're doing the right hand part of that enzyme, this pathway. Okay, and you're using it. The glycogen breakdown has three enzymes: glycogen phosphorylase, debranching, phosphoglucomutase. The synthesis has three enzymes. Four. Phosphoglucomutase, UTP glucose pyrophosphorylase, glycogen synthase, and branching enzyme to make the glycogen. Now, those of you who have not had breakfast, you've basically used up all of your glycogen from last night, unless you had a late... What time did you eat late? How late did you eat? Six. And you haven't eaten since then?
I think I had a couple of
cheeses. Oh, well, never mind. Anyway, so in her liver, there's virtually no glycogen. After 12 hours of fasting, under normal circumstances, especially someone with your energy levels, no glycogen in there. So what is she using to think? And why do I say that? What is she using to think? Well, I know, but what small molecule is your brain dependent on for its energy? Glucose. 20% of the aerobic utilization of your body occurs in the 3 pounds called your brain. Within a 24-hour period, any 24-hour period, 99% of the energy that your brain uses is being used by, comes from glucose. So where is she getting the glucose that her brain is using right now? What is it?
From her creamer.
From her creamer, apparently. Yeah. That's good thinking. No, it doesn't matter where it comes from. Please say the following term: gluconeogenesis.
Gluconeogenesis.
Come on. It's all right. Be more enthusiastic. Did you have breakfast?
Sort of.
Okay, well, he's not using glucose. Gluconeogenesis uses small molecules, primarily amino acids, and forms it into glucose. And that gets dumped into the blood from the liver. And that's what her brain is living on, is gluconeogenesis. She's using up some excess amino acids in her blood and other locations to make glucose so her brain can work. Okay? All right, any questions about this one? Good, let's go ahead. Let's take a look at some of this. Glycogen, it's a storage form of carbohydrate in mammals and plants. It's primarily alpha-1-4 bonds and amylopectin, alpha-1-6. Glycogen, amylopectin, but alpha-1-6 every 8 to 10. Exists in cytoplasmic gut modules with up to 120,000 glucose units. Wow. Maximally, it's about 1 to 2% by weight, and liver up to 10% of your weight is glycogen of the liver. It's up to 12 hours of energy storage. Why? Mobilizes fat. Mobilizes faster than fat. Fat cannot be anaerobically metabolized. That means fat has to have oxygen. If you're running faster than your oxygen capacity, that means a significant amount of your energy for running is coming from anaerobic capacity. You're making something. You're getting energy anaerobically. And it's not from fat. Okay? Fat cannot be anaerobically metabolized. And three, you cannot convert fat to glucose. You cannot convert fat from glucose. There is no mechanism for you to convert fat into glucose. This is why after 3 days of starvation, your body will eventually, your brain will eventually shift over its metabolism from glucose into things called ketone bodies, which are basically fat equivalents, water-soluble fat equivalents. And here we go. There's a picture of glycogen. Here's the regular, another picture of glycogen. Are you done writing this stuff in?
No.
Well, hurry up, man. Life is good. Now, that's people, this is among the most surprising things that people don't understand. They think if glucose can be made into fat, which it can, then fat ought to be able to be made into glucose. Which, you know, I suppose in a rational point of view, that should be able to be, that's probably true. But that's not. Primarily because fat is broken down into two carbon units, acetyl-CoA primarily. But the minimum number of carbons that have to be together in a unit to make glucose is 3. So you cannot make glucose from fat. May I go on? Thank you very much. Okay, glycogen synthesis, ladies and gentlemen. Glycogen synthesis. How do you make glycogen? Okay. Do you need... What? Those are tiny. There you go. That's right. Did I drive people nuts when I whistle? I'm sorry. Is that any better? Is that big enough? All right, fine. No, that's fine. I can. Well, I'm worried about people in the back. Let's make this 200%. And let's bring this over here. Okay, is that better? Okay. Now then, how do you make glycogen, ladies and gentlemen? How do you make it? How do you make glycogen? The reason why we're going this right now is because we're going to be doing some heavy-duty glycogen regulation. Okay. And this is fascinating stuff from my point of view. Okay. Now, as you know, obviously, since you're synthesizing, you require energy to synthesize stuff. Stuff doesn't occur spontaneously. Very, very, very little of it does. And your energy source for making glycogen comes from, oddly enough, UTP. Uridine triphosphate. Not ATP, but UTP. And there are 3 main steps to it. There's an initiating step that you see right here. This is also called the priming step. It's the initiation of glycogen polymer synthesis. You take glucose and glycogenin. Now, glycogenin is a protein, oddly enough. And so at the center of every glycogen molecule is a protein called glycogenin. And it attaches a glucose. There's an enzyme that attaches a glucose onto one of the tyrosines of glycogenin. And you can tell that it attaches to a tyrosine because of the name of the enzyme. Tyrosine, glucosyl transferase, and you make this glucose glycogen nucleus, or nuclei, or priming step. Then the glycogenin gets up to 7 more glucoses that then can make a segment that glycogen synthase can act on. All right, so what is the enzyme that breaks down glucose? Thank you very much, Mr. Casey. Would you like to shout that out nice and loud?
Glycogen phosphorylase.
That's as loud as you can get?
At this time
in the morning, that's right. Now, you being a morning person, Dr. Novak, apparently can shout out any time. So, how do you break down glycogen? What's the enzyme? How do you make it? Glycogen synthase. Synthase. Actually, but of course, glycogen synthase. But of course, the nucleus, the little pebble, the little building block, is this tyrosine glycogen phosphorylase, which makes this glucose glycogen beginning scaffold. Now, in order for glycogen synthase to operate, notice you take glycogen and you react it with a high energy molecule called what? UDP what? Glucose. And that adds 1 more glucose to the glycogen and you get this resulting product UDP. Where do you get the UDP glucose from? That's a high energy molecule. You get it from this enzyme called UDP glucose pyrophosphorylase. You got glucose 1-phosphate, you got the UDP, you got your water, and you make this UDP glucose, sometimes called UDPG, and 2 inorganic phosphates. Notice the pyrophosphate is cleaved to 2 phosphates to drive the reaction nuts. You like the word nuts? Drive the reaction forward. Forward. All right. Provide a high-energy reactant for glycogen synthase. I must have struck a nerve with poor Evan Lowe. Any rate, so you have this. Now you have this high-energy glucose, UDP glucose. The enzyme, this UDP glucose, then is acted right here, and the enzyme that's acting at this point is called glycogen synthase. Now, notice if you would, it says synthase. If it said synthetase, it'd be using ATP.
Ooh, what did I just say? Oh, if it was a synthetase, it would be using ATP, but synthases don't use ATP directly. Now, the enzyme has a T and an R form.
A T and an R form. A T stands for what? And an R stands for what? Which one is it in the, what, which one do you think is it in the active form, the T or the R? The R is the active form and the T is the inactive form. All right? So it has a T and an R form, not a T or an R form. So there's a population of glycogen synthases. There's some that are T and some that are R. And you can shift the relative proportion. You got to watch me dance. I don't dance very often. You got to shift the relative proportion based on regulation. Either allosteric, which is a temporary conformational change, or covalent, which is a permanent enzymatically activated form change. Now, the phosphorylated implies that's a covalent modification. It also can be, the equilibrium between the forms can be shifted by allosteric effectors, inhibited by ATP, ADPPI, and it is inactivated when phosphorylated. All right? Alright, so it's inhibited by these forms, and you need to know these forms. You need to know these forms, and we'll explain why that makes sense a little later. And then also, finally, if you got the glycogen, what bond is the glycogen making? 1,4? Alpha 1,4s or alpha 1,6s? What's the glycogen synthase making? 1,4s only. If you only had glycogen synthase, you'd only make what form of glycogen? Amylose or amylopectin? Amylose. Well, we know amylose is not the only thing. So there's got to be a glycogen branching enzyme called amylo 1,4 to 1,6 transglycolase. One of the reasons I like this is that I love these names because they're so descriptive. They're Amylo 1,4 to 1,6 transglycosylase. Now, what does that 1,4 to 1,6 imply? You're changing a 1,4 branch point or connection into a what? 1,6. See, in the biochemistry is not rocket science. It's just there's a lot. Yes?
Is that the same enzyme as the one used for glycogen breakdown?
No. This glycogen branching enzyme is not the same. He asked, is that the same enzyme as the debranching enzyme? Is that what you basically asked? Yeah, no, it's not. The two enzymes are completely different. It's not the reverse of the debranching enzyme. All right. Okay, excellent. Shall we? Let's go back here. Was that helpful to expand it? Yes, of course it was. Now, the glycogen phosphorylase. Allosteric regulation and covalent modification. Now, again, why am I hammering this? Because it's happening right now in your body. Of course, except for Ryan, who's completely asleep. And
no, I'm not.
Now, yes, you are. Go ahead and sleep if you need to sleep. But, of course, not here, because I'm going to tease you unmercifully if you do. Now, PI is a positive homotropic effector. Huh? Huh? Why is that true? A positive, let's parse that phrase. Positive effector, that means the presence of PI accelerates the enzyme activity. Homotropic effector. Now notice what we're doing. We're talking glycogen phosphorylase. And what's going on with the glycogen phosphorylase? Well, glycogen breaking down into glucose 1-phosphate. Is there any phosphate in glycogen? No. Well, then the product is phosphorylated, glycogen phosphorylase. You got that phosphate right there. Where do we get it? We get it from its environment. There's inorganic phosphate in your cells, and that's captured as glucose 1-phosphate. So inorganic phosphate, that PI, is a substrate for this particular reaction. Ding, 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 ding. Okay. So that's why, see, homotropic, it meant that it's both a substrate and an activator. So positive homotropic effector. High levels of phosphate produce a feed-forward activation of glycogen phosphorylase. ATP is a feedback inhibitor. Now, is ATP a part of the reaction here? Glycogen to glucose 6-phosphate. Do you see ATP as a substrate anywhere in there? Yes or no? No. Okay. So that means, since it's an inhibitor, that means it has a negative effector, but it's heterotropic because it's not a part of the substrate requirements. All right. Glucose 6-phosphate is a heterotropic inhibitor, and AMP is a positive heterotropic effector. In other words, AMP stimulates glycogen breakdown. I wonder why that might be. Why do you think AMP would stimulate glycogen breakdown? What do you know about the relative energy inherent in ATP versus AMP? If your cell has a lot of AMP, a relatively high proportion of AMP within its confines, does that cell have lots of energy storage or a lack of energy storage? A lack, because AMP is the low energy form of the phosphate, adenosine phosphate. So this means that there's a lack of energy in the cell. And would you think that to get more energy, if you could add more glucose to the glycolytic pathway, we could get more energy in the cell? Yeah. So if AMP turns on glycogen phosphorylase, would that help negate the energy lack in the cell? Yeah. So does it make rational sense why AMP is a positive heterotropic effector or an activator? Does that make sense? Yeah, because it's a measure of the energy status of the cell. It's a low energy molecule, low energy status, need more energy, break down glycogen if you got it. So glycogen phosphorylase turns out to be a bit of a computer, a sensor, both a sensor and a computer. I got a couple of seconds here. All right, so Krebs and Fischer discovered a converting enzyme. 3 years later, Krebs and Fischer showed a covalent modification, phosphorylation. This phosphorylation is mediated by enzyme cascade. Regulation of glycogen phosphorylase by covalent modification. Now, you know, when I was taking this in college, I thought, wow, you know, this has been around forever. This information was 1956, 1959. How old was I in 1959? I was 6 years old in 1959, ladies and gentlemen. In other words, within my lifetime, they discovered glycogen phosphorylase and began to have some idea about how it was regulated. In my lifetime. Now do you understand why you live in such a wonderful time in Earth's history? Don't let the negativism of today's society tell you that you live in a terrible time. It may be a stressful time, but it's certainly not a terrible time. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to hit this right here hard. And we're going to hit this hard. And we're going to hit this hard, basically. So, tomorrow, what I need for you to do is get a good night's sleep tonight. All right?
Not going to happen.
Why? What's happening tomorrow?
Acting test.
Oh, no. Seriously?
Yeah, we'll be taking
our test. Okay. Would it be best for me to move out of your way? Should we just not have class tomorrow and have class on Thursday?
Yeah, actually.
Would that be bad or good?
Good.
What? What pre-med assembly?
Dr. Blue is coming.
Yeah, I know, but what would that have to do with Biochem 1? Would it be best for us not to have class tomorrow?
No.
No? Yes? Are you just being mean?
Mean?
No? No, she's never mean. I don't know. I'm sorry, Gretchen. We're just going to have class tomorrow. We'll have class tomorrow as usual, not have class on Thursday. Okay. I'll make sure I record it, though. What?
Oh, yeah, we're done with clicker quizzes for a while.